My name is Darren Hupke, and this is Pixels and Polygons. Welcome to the final episode of Pixels and Polygons. I'm just kidding. It's the final episode in this format. I'm going to kind of shake things up and maybe we'll call it season two. I don't know. But it'll continue on weekly. I'm not going to take any time off. Things will continue to be available to you. And the same structure of the show will be answering one of the video game questions or prompts to my guest and hearing the answer. But instead of having two guests on each episode with them answering the questions front and back, I'm going to just have one guest. So the runtime may shrink a little bit, but in addition to asking an icebreaker, we'll kind of just chat, talk shop a little bit about games we're currently playing and maybe what we're looking forward to. Maybe just spending like 5-10 minutes doing that before the icebreaker and before jumping into the main topic. So I still hope to have the episodes probably around the 20-minute mark, you know, if the conversation's good and it runs long to 30 minutes, even better. Yeah, that's going to be the new format I kind of want to structure. The reason I want to do this is just it helps as far as editing goes and scheduling. Sometimes it is just like an avalanche of folks, and I just schedule a bunch of conversations back to back, and I've got a ton of pending episodes that I can edit together. But then sometimes nobody answers the same questions, and so I'm trying to like force schedule some responses there. So it's fun, and I still get to have all the conversations, but instead of needing that weird back end shuffle and that kind of land grab that I need to do in order to put it together, it'll be set up in a way that it'll help me just kind of get it out consistently without any extra strange editing stress from scheduling wise. So you won't see much change, and it should still be the same fun, entertaining podcast, hopefully, to continue to enjoy. But that's it. So this last double format episode is going to be with Aiden Moyer and Luis Aguasivivas, who have been on recent episodes and have been great conversations. So hopefully you enjoy this last double feature, and next week we'll be back in the new format. I got no other business really up for, actually, I take that back. No, I have a Kickstarter going on for, this kind of flash in the pan idea that just came to me, Retro Game Zine. So, I figured in between my big book projects, or in between just kind of, creative time spent working on these bigger book projects, I'd like a little palate cleanser. And so, the idea of doing like a little, micro zine or just like a little, you know, fun zine, on a single game or a single topic, was something I wanted to explore. And, I've backed like, you know, other Kickstarters and bought other, zines like this. Forgotten Worlds is like a really big one that I've recently been buying. And, they also have a Kickstarter going on for their newest issue. But those types of things inspired me to maybe just kind of do my own. So, Retro Game Zine is the project. The first issue is currently live on Kickstarter. It'll be 20-ish pages. If there's like overfunding, you know, I'll add a few extra pages and stuff to it. But you can see that there. It covers the game It Came from the Desert. It was an old computer game. I originally played it on a MS-DOS computer. But it was available in 1989 and 1990 on those original platforms. But it was just a fun game from my childhood. I did a little write up on the history of it, a little personal story and an essay about it and an intro to it, gathered up some screenshots and some cool relics, and talked about the later ports that it went to, like on TurboGrafx-16 CD and things like that. But yeah, you can see the link to that in the show notes below. I don't want to take up too much time, but the funding's been going really well, and I actually just announced a stretch goal, which will be a second issue all bundled together with the first. That is the same format that covers the history and talks about a cool classic Sega Genesis game. So take a look there if you want to read more about that or hear more about that and support. Otherwise, enjoy this episode, and we'll see you next week in the new format. Bye. All right. Well, welcome to another episode of Pixels and Polygons. We've got now a newer guest, but a returning guest. Our friend of the show, Aiden's here again. So hello. Welcome to another episode.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
If you listen to his previous episode, I'll have the same like links and everything in the show notes, so you kind of follow along and keep up with the writings and everything he's been doing. But to get into it, to start with an icebreaker, just to kind of shake you up. You know the main question, but you don't know this. Let me ask you. I'll try this one. This is a one I haven't tried on a lot of folks. Let's see if there's something new that comes to mind. But while I don't condone throwing controllers, what is a memorable controller throwing moment that you have?
Oh, yeah, 100% Gran Turismo on the original PlayStation. Just doing the license trials. I can't remember the exact specific one, but I had to take a particular line through a corner, and I just could not get it. Controller was thrown. So were some knuckles. I believe there is still an indentation in my parents' drywall, like in my old bedroom, where I punched the wall and left some knuckle divots, because I just couldn't get that that trial down to get like my new license or whatever in Gran Turismo. So that's the one that comes to mind, big time.
Yeah, those.
I also threw my hat the other day playing Astro Bot in one of the challenge levels.
I love those challenge levels. I haven't lost it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I don't.
I'm happy they're there because while I was enjoying the nostalgia of playing it, and I loved like finding all the different like characters to have them back in the hub world. Like nothing was particularly like difficult, and I was like, "That's okay. Yeah. This game's not difficult. I'm totally fine with that." And then boom, you start unlocking those like little controller icon like challenge levels, and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, this is what I want to do. And yeah, there were some controller. The final one is even worse than everything you've like experienced up to that point.
I actually don't mind. I don't mind the final one. I think it's like learnable, and like you get better at it as you go along. And there's two. I guess I won't spoil it because the game's pretty new. There's two that in particular that I think are questionably designed because there's a bit too much randomness to them compared to the other challenge levels. But in any case, that's a whole different episode, I suppose.
That's fun. Cool. Well, that's a good controller throwing moment for sure. I loved those license tests for sure. I think that I was okay with just having like... Well, I think this is the A-class license to do essentially a majority of the game with. Like, you really didn't need, like, the higher tier ones unless you were going super hardcore into it. So yeah. I was okay with having the A for a majority of the game before I try to bang my head against the wall. But cool. Let's jump into the meat of the episode. I don't know why I said it like that. I'm also vegetarian, too, so saying the meat so emphatically is just kind of strange. But this week's episode, we want to answer the question, what is your least favorite game in one of your favorite gaming franchises? So it doesn't have to be your number one favorite, but obviously a franchise you do love. What is one of your least favorite games in it? So I'd kind of like to hear what that is, what the franchise is, and then reveal to us what that game is.
Sure. So I came into this episode with a plan. You know, like I said, I have a background in Japanese RPGs. My book was about the history of Final Fantasy, and I was going to come in and kind of talk smack about Final Fantasy X, which I believe kind of like, you know, laid the groundwork for some of the questionable choices that I feel like are still hampering the series to this day. But I'm calling it audible. I'm changing course because I'm really excited about the Lunar remaster coming out next year. And so I'm going to surface some suppressed memories about the Nintendo DS Lunar game called Lunar Dragon Song, which is and remains the worst game I've ever finished. And it is not just like a black mark on Lunar, because it fundamentally like misunderstood so much of what worked so well about the first two games in the series, which are beloved to me. But it's just a series of like unforced error after unforced error after unforced error. That was just, you know, like a development team or a director or somebody who was just trying to be a little too clever. And so, like, to kind of roll back for people who don't know the Lunar series, Lunar 1 and 2 were Sega CD Japanese RPGs in a fairly typical, like, golden age JRPG mold. And so they don't really surprise you with their gameplay. What they really excel on is world that really feels natural and fun to be in, something that has high stakes because you care about the characters in your party, the characters that, and the people that sort of surround them, the places that you visit. And so when that's put into peril, you're really invested. I like to call them like Saturday morning cartoon games. So you had like more serious games at that time. By the time they were remade on the PlayStation and Saturn, you had games like Suikoden, and you had Final Fantasy VII, and you had you know, stuff like Vagrant Story coming up, Xenogears, and those were sort of more interested in telling more, like, you know, complex or political or, you know, quote unquote grown up stories. Whereas Lunar just really leans into like just a lot of cartoon tropes and, you know, shonen anime tropes. And I just love that about it. I love how earnest it was at a time when, you know, a lot of RPGs during the PlayStation era were getting really serious. And so you got those two games on the Sega CD, the Saturn, and PlayStation. Then there was Lunar Magic Story, which was like a Game Gear geek, like side story where you went to a magic school. It was remade for the Saturn, never released in the West, but it also kind of retained the whimsy of the original games. You know, it wasn't very good, but it also wasn't offensive. And then there's Dragon Song, which is ostensibly Lunar 3. But it has a whole new cast. It doesn't bring forward anybody that, you know, is very, you know, memorable or invest, you know, people are invested in. And what worked really well about Lunar 2 is that it brought forward and expanded on storylines and characters and settings that were explored in the first game. And then you visited them many, many, many years later and saw how they changed or how they were impacted by the events of the original Lunar. Dragon Song kind of threw all that out the window for just a really generic storyline that didn't really hit on any of the notes that made the first two effective. But its like biggest sin was just cramming all these weird systems unnecessarily into an otherwise bog standard Japanese RPG, like console or handheld RPG. The big ones being, so every RPG you kind of run around or you walk around and then you press a button to run, and Lunar's Dragon Song is the same. But if you hold the run button down, you just slowly lose HP for some reason. Mm-hmm. Like, that's never really explained. I guess it's supposed to be a stamina system, but why you would have, so like Lunar, I think, was it Lunar 2 has like a dash run? So you can dash for short periods of time. I'm pretty sure that's how it works in Lunar 2. So like, if you want to have a stamina system, like, fine. If you have on screen like enemies instead of random battles, but punishing the player by just slowing them down to like walking speed just because they don't want their resources depleted just isn't fun. And it wasn't implemented in a fun way or an interesting way. And then on top of that, they had other like gameplay systems. Like when you were in battle, you could choose to get experience or golden loot. So you couldn't fight a battle and get the gold and the loot and experience. You had to toggle between modes. You're either leveling up or you're resource gathering, but not both at the same time. Again, for absolutely no reason. I don't think there's an in-universe reason for this. There's certainly not a compelling gameplay reason for this. You just have to fight double the battles to get the same amount of resources you would have in any other game. And it was just sort of an experimental, like, it felt like it was trying to be experimental with like accepted systems and like push the genre forward, but every single toggle they switched just felt like it made the game more irritating for the player without any sort of benefit. And so that just, you know, like totally sucked away the fact that, you know, you're back in this world kind of exploring something that felt a little familiar. Like, it would have been inoffensive if to play a game that was a little bland, you know, as Lunar 3, but the fact that they made it harder and more irritating on top of the fact that it was bland was just something that I, to me, was just unforgivable. And I've tried to memory hole that game as much as possible, but it's hard because it was
I remember as an RPG fan, like for the DS to get, like, I think it was basically like being advertised like the first big RPG for the system. I think it may have been the first like traditional RPG for the system. Like, I was pumped. I was like, all right, finally, like, this will be something cool. Like, yes, I have that Game Boy Advance slot and I have plenty of great like GBA ones I can still play, but like, cool, this is something to take advantage of this hardware. I'm gonna love this. I remember buying it, and that game still had a manual, but like inside it had like character intros, and it talked about the main character, and like it said like their hobbies were like standing on their head.
Oh yeah,
I'm
yeah,
what? This is so weird. Like, what do you mean standing on their head? Like, this doesn't make any sense. Maybe this is a translation error. I don't know what's going on here. And then actually booting up the game and your literal introduction to him, he's just doing a handstand and like. Like, and so in my head, I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is one of the traits that this character has that makes him unique, like a character defining thing. His hobby is just doing headstands. Like, how am I ever going to take this game seriously?
Yeah. Not even like, you know, martial arts, like it's standing on his head, which is just like, that's about the level of depth that you get in that game.
Yeah, that was concern one. And then once you jump into the battle system, like, you know, okay, attack, item, so you know, whatever you're gonna pick, once you select attack, like, that's it. Like, you don't choose who you want to attack or anything.
Gosh, I forgot about that.
It'll randomly assign that, and I don't know if the AI like knew to attack in a certain order, if there was like a secret like gambit system in the background happening, you know, like, but it was just, from all intents and purposes, it was just like randomly selecting an enemy to attack. So you couldn't all group up and attack one to take it out. It was like evenly distributing like attacks. That's right. And it, like, why change that? Like, it was so,
it felt
crazy.
Like, they like were insecure about making a 15-hour RPG. You know, so every, like, they just tweaked all of these things, like, oh, fight double the battles. Oh, you can only walk, you can't run. Oh, we won't let them, attack efficiently in battle. It's like, that'll add 7 to 10 hours onto the, you know, the course of the game. And like you mentioned the GBA port on the DS, and the GBA had an okay remake of Lunar Silver Star Story called Lunar Legend. And so they had a template there that, like, Lunar Legend is an inoffensive remake of Lunar the Silver Star. It's fine. I like it. Like, I personally have a warm spot for it, but it's an example of a fine, inoffensive, if not great, remake of Lunar. They could have just taken that template, used the top screen in interesting ways. Because one thing that Lunar Dragon Song does, to its credit, I suppose, is it makes use of the top and the bottom screen. So your characters in battle are sort of on the bottom screen, and then you'll get enemies that are, you know, like, span both screens. And I think it sometimes would take into account like distance from the characters for attacks, maybe. And so, you know, you implement something like that. You implement a map on the bottom, like, and you could have had a perfectly inoffensive Lunar 3 that nobody remembers, but also nobody is dogging on a, you know, on a podcast 20 years later, right? Which is what Dragon Song ended up being. And so, you know, I don't know who made Dragon Song, or if anybody who worked on Lunar Legend was involved with Dragon Song, but they could have at least just looked at that as a template and just built out, you know, the story from Dragon Song in that. Wouldn't have been great, but it would have been fine.
Yeah. The one thing I will give points to it for, I don't know why I liked it. Like, I don't think everyone did, but, like, you know, every Nintendo 64, not every, but Nintendo 64 games are often like Doom 64, Super Mario 64. They just threw 64 at the end. For the DS, I like that people came up with like the acronym DS, but made it like a different title. So this Dragon Song DS, like that, like, oh, okay, I like that you're playing along there. Like, Castlevania Dawn of Souls was DS. Like, there were things that did that cleverly. And I like that Lunar played along with that. That might be the only thing I'm charmed by the game, unfortunately.
That is, you know, and that does go back to the idea that it was one of those early DS titles where you saw that a lot. But I'm just reading about it on Wikipedia. It actually takes place thousands of years before the first Lunar game, which was probably, you know, like, Lunar was so strongly built around the identity of the world and the characters that inhabited the first game and then the second game, that, like, that really sort of took away from Dragon Song's ability to to, you know, to fit in with the rest of those in a way that was satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. And now we have that remake, that collection of the first two coming out to modern consoles, which looks rad.
Looks very good.
Yeah. Yep. I think that I'll be picking that up for sure on day one. I've been obsessed with like the resurgence of like that HD 2D look that Square's done, but like really like I'll put up with any cool, like high resolution pixel art. So like, I think that'll be rad to look at and see for sure.
Yeah, I agree. It looks cool. And I like that the fact that like the remasters give you the option to kind of turn on the, like, you know, the tilt shift effect if you want it or not, which I think is really good.
I did not see that was possible. So that's cool.
Yeah.
Like
You can kind of switch between the two. It doesn't change too much, I don't think, but it's in there a little bit, which is cool.
Yeah. Just give me some drop shadows on those pixels and it's good enough for me. You know,
there you go. Interested. It's funny how like Octopath, you know, really kind of opened up a new era of, like retro style RPGs in that way. Yeah. That probably wouldn't have existed without Octopath.
Yeah, I'm so happy for that. I didn't play the first Octopath. I think it was out on Switch, I believe, only at least initially.
Initially.
And then when 2 came out on PlayStation, I was like, well, I don't need to have played the first one, right? Like, I'm sure this will be fine for me. And I was just like instantly like hooked to that thing. I platinum trophied that thing. And like now I want to go back to the first one now that it's available on PlayStation. And now everything, like the Dragon Quest 3 that's coming up soon, all those things, I'm like, give me all of them. Like right now, I'll take all of them.
Yeah. Octopath 2 is particularly good. I put about 40 hours into the first one before something else came out and I kind of put it aside, and then I picked up the second one, and it's just the first game. Like, it's like, you almost can't even point to where the improvements are, but everything's just more expertly crafted and well put together that it just feels better without being obviously better. Like some sequels can be.
Yeah.
So I'd be curious to hear what you think of the first one after going back, having played the second one first. But just given my background, as I said, I write about retro RPGs and stuff. I really am happy to see that game companies and publishers are taking that aesthetic, that style seriously.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I'm really happy about is the way that like Octopath and subsequent games have shown that publishers are really taking like that retro style, that golden age Japanese RPG or console RPG style seriously as a way to make compelling games and not something to like run from or quote unquote improve.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, then I think we can pretty much wrap that there then. I like that we visited the Lunar series, and I'm glad. Like, I knew as soon as you said that this was going to be about Dragon Song. Like, there's not another game in it. Like, it's
never seen anybody say anything good about Dragon Song. Like, some games like have a little like, you know, devoted fan base, but Dragon Song, like, everybody just pants Dragon Song because it was like so avoidably bad. Mm-hmm. Like, there were so many like conscious decisions made by the people making it that ruined the experience.
Poor Dragon Song.
Sorry, Dragon Song.
We'll have the remakes and we'll have the memories of that coming back to us, of the good stuff, here next year. Thanks for joining me on another episode then, Aiden. We'll definitely have you on in more in the future for sure. Have a good one.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Welcome to another episode of Pixels and Polygons. I got Luis back with us on another episode. So hello, Luis.
Hey, how you doing? How's everybody? I hope they're doing well. I hope that the crazy season hasn't been too crazy for people and that they're safe.
Yeah, crazy's gonna crazy. The world's gonna world right now. So yeah, stay safe and find some games to enjoy to bring down some stress levels if that's your thing. I wanted to jump into it with you with an icebreaker question to have some funds or have some fun and kickstart the mind on the main topic. But I figured let's ask more of a vacation destination or a soothing one. If you could live in any gaming world, what world would that be?
Oh my God, that's so tough. Oh, that's so tough. There's so many. It's funny because I usually play stressful games. So I wouldn't necessarily live in any of those places. All right, I'm going to say something right now, and it's probably going to be weird, but you know what? In the Pikmin planet, I'll do that. And I'll be a Pikmin. And I know that's super stressful, but that's fine. I'll do that.
Just a casual life as a Pikmin, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I'll probably just live like one day and then I'll die, but I think it'll be glorious.
Is the lore of Pikmin, like, I've never really dug much like into it, but just remembering like playing the original, like, is it supposed to be like on Earth and like Olimar isn't necessarily a human? He's from another planet, because you know there's like large like cans and you can see like old kind of like human like elements that are like larger than life. I've always been curious about that. Like,
yeah, you see like these backdrops on it that look like if it's like, you know, the real world or like our world. But I mean, it's the planet is called like PNF-404, which is like a play on like page not found, you know, for that error that you get when when you're like looking for like a website and the website is gone, which is pretty funny. But yeah, it just has, I like it because it's like, it's not really explained. A lot of the looks like stuff that's familiar to us. I mean, just some stuff is straight up things you only going to find on Earth, right? Especially in the first two games where you had like brands on there, like Duracell batteries, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in Pikmin 4, you have a lot of like Nintendo, like actual like Nintendo memorabilia on there. So, but it's,
yeah,
I think you can go by that. I think it's fun just to leave it as like that. It's like, oh, this looks like Earth, but not really like trying to like tie it in 100%. Because there's a lot of differences on there still, though. Like these creatures that are there, like even though they're big also for Olimar, they're not really that big for us, most of them at least.
Yeah.
So it's like,
yeah, it could be that it's just in the not too distant future where we start outsourcing our garbage and like launch it into space. And coincidentally, some of our garbage has landed on this planet. And that's why the cross contamination is there. But I'm not here to fill. I'm not here to fill the plot holes of Pikmin. But it is there are some soothing areas. And then, you know, what is the life cycle of a Pikmin itself? You know, I don't know, but at least it's not as stressful as it could be. I think that's a good location. I think it's a cool choice there. So
I think it's still less stressful than the real world, than our horrible society. So yeah, just, you know, if only thing I have to worry about is not being eaten, I think that's a better deal.
There you go. All right. Well, thanks for participating there. Let's move on into the main topic then, because I'm really curious to hear what you've selected for this question. But we've asked this before, and I do like to ask this just to kind of hear. Usually, you know, it's a fan trying to make excuses for certain things, but I just love hearing the reasons for it. But what is your least favorite game in one of your favorite franchises?
A great question. That had me stumped also for a bit, but I ultimately decided on the series is going to be Metal Gear. And the game is going to be Metal Gear Solid 4, Guns of the Patriots.
4, okay.
That's my least favorite game, and that almost killed the series for me. Like, I had such, it's weird because when it came out, there was so many, like, the reviews were just like raving, but I did not enjoy it at all. I mean, there was not that much to enjoy. I mean, unless you wanted to watch like 30 hours of cutscenes, right? So it's like, it was a big shock for me. And it was, I think it's the first time that I played a game where like the critical consensus was so different from like my own opinion on it, right? Like at least it's like when I was starting to follow like what critics, right, and people were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I remember like people calling it like the greatest game ever or like all this stuff, but I was just like, oh, this game sucks.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you feel the same way for me, but like my love for the Metal Gear series, like I think by the time 4 came out, and I think 3 definitely was the last game, especially in the Solid series, like with those mechanics and that specific design that I think I wanted to play. Like I think it needed to evolve like its gameplay and what it can do. And so it seemed like 4 tried that with some interesting like new mechanics and some like bizarre new things to do, like in addition to the root of the gameplay, but the root gameplay still was quite structured in like the same kind of format. And then beyond that, it with all the extra sprinkling of mechanics, having your stealth camouflage, having this ability to try and have two factions pitted against each other or minimize their resources or whatever it may be. You played 10 minutes and then you watched 15 minutes of a cutscene, or you were in an area that was, you know, a fraction of the size of what you were expecting, like a larger, like open environment to be. And so like, you never really got to get in deep and get into the weeds of like all of these mechanics and systems, because you're being sprinkled and pushed along like through the plot and through a lot of like cinematic moments to these smaller different areas that never really let it stretch its wings and be like confident in what it was. It was like based on the past, but not quite pushing itself to the future and kind of just in this like hybrid in between.
No, like well said. And like, and that was a big, that game showed me a lot though. Like it showed me a lot of like stuff that I just wasn't willing to like tolerate, right, as like a player. Because I do think obviously the look of the game was cutting edge for the time. It looked amazing. And it's also, and I mean, if you like the, you know, the Kojima like nonsense story stuff, you know, it can be fairly entertaining. But for me, I just felt there was just so much of it and just so little gameplay. Like a game like Snake Eater and Metal Gear Solid, you know, the first one, those are, you had a lot of cutscenes, but you had a lot of time to play. And especially those two, like the gameplay just was so different. Metal Gear Solid being pretty much, at least for that I've played, like the very first like action adventure stealth game in 3D that I enjoyed, right? I mean, it birthed like that genre, and then Snake Eater took that but like added like just so much more, where you have like open elements where you're just like outside like in the wilderness, plus you also have like sections where you're that you're like in more like confined, like closed spaces. And you can play it. You have a lot of flexibility in play, which I think that's something that doesn't really get talked enough about the series is, until 5. I think 5 was the one that people realized, oh, you can really play this like your way. Like you could be like, do essentially like the pacifist route, or do like a more heavily stealth route, or you can just try to just like brute force your way through everything. Metal Gear 4, even though it made a lot of really interesting like additions to the gameplay, as you were saying, you know, it didn't give you like that much time to do it. And I remember there was, I mean, I haven't played this game since 2008. That's like how like strong of a reaction I had against it.
Yeah, and it was like, it's the same for me. Like I've not been able to replay it since it's been locked on the PS3, but it's all memory.
And it's like there were times where like there would be a cutscene, whatever, some unfathomable amount of time that you're watching this cutscene, and then you would just like control Snake for like 30 seconds, and then there'll be another unfathomably long like cutscene, and I'm like, what the hell is this? You know, it's like, it was infuriating to me. I mean, you can argue that it's kind of like, I don't know how intentional that is when it comes to like being like a fun little like subversive stuff, like Metal Gear Solid 2, where it's like, oh, you have like all these awesome toys and it's like, but you're going to be doing this instead. But regardless, I just didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was also a victim too of just like, like Kojima kept wanting to like exit the director chair and like kind of move on, but he was being constantly pulled back in to do it. And so like, I think ultimately, you know, having attempted to walk away before 3 and then being pulled back into that for 3, like this game then seemed to have to like, okay, well, we have to tie up threads from Metal Gear Solid. And then we introduced a whole lot of new threads, the Patriots, all of these, you know, crazy, like, big picture, like, world building things that 2 built with, like, Raiden and everything as well. And then in 3, introducing even more, you know, Naked Snake and things from the past and even more concepts that, like, you know, tie into the overall lore. So 4 comes along and you have Solid Snake's story, but then you are still trying to, you know, see all these other characters you've met along the way through all those games, and everything was trying to have its plot like resolved, but there's just so much meat on the bone that like it was an impossible task unless exactly that. There's I think it's a like a 45 minute cutscene at about the midway point of the game, and then the ending of it itself, I think it clocks in at well over 60 minutes. It might even be close to 90 minutes, but yeah, it's, I am a fan, like, you know, still, like, the 4 is towards the bottom of my list for the Metal Gear franchise, for sure. I agree with you there. And I'm a fan of, Kojima's craziness and everything, but, like, that definitely tested my patience and my limits as well. Like, even with the cool nods to, like, Snatcher and, you know, having the like, disguise of, like, the Gillian Seed, like, jacket and everything and the Metal Gear Mark II and all that stuff, there's cool little nods to lots of things. There was just also just the constant, you know, what if, or like, I want more feeling while you were being paced along.
It was definitely a lot for me. And that was also like a weird transitional phase for me as a, you know, as a player, where I was really into JRPGs, you know, especially stuff like Final Fantasy, where essentially I would play Final Fantasy in my mind to get the reward, which would be like the cutscenes, right? Like something like in Final Fantasy X. So I was kind of used to that, you know, type of style of game. But Metal Gear Solid 4 just did it. It was just so long. It really got me. And frankly, in a lot of cutscenes, I fell asleep. I was just like, because they were just so long. And I think that was the one too. I kind of became a little bit more critical and less of a fan of a lot of like Kojima's like antics and like views when it comes to, you know, like international politics. So that definitely had an effect on my enjoyment of the game. I guess I think it plays like for its time, it plays great. It just doesn't give you that much time to do that. And yeah. I actually did enjoy the last boss fight, which is essentially like that fist fight. I thought that was like a really interesting way of ending it. But it's still, you know, I don't know. I would actually be interested to see. I'm sure somebody's done it where they see like how much time you're actually playing as opposed to how much time you're actually like watching cutscenes on it. And I know it's probably like less than 20% of the game is you playing, and then the others just like you watching cutscenes.
Yeah, I'd love to know that number too. I'm going to do some Googling after this and see if what that breakdown is. Because yeah, I'd be curious to know. Like even if it's like you give a generous, not necessarily a speed run path through it, but if you give some generous time to the gameplay, you know, how much time is that balanced against like how many minutes there are or hours there are of cutscenes? I want to see.
Yeah. No, I mean, another reason I picked this game too is because there's other games that I definitely dislike more in a series, right, that I love than Metal Gear Solid 4. But this is one where, you know, there's enough games in this series that I have more to compare it to, like games before and after as well. So it's a game that falls. I mean, I wouldn't, even though like Rising Revengeance, it's like part of the same, which is a game that I think is like amazing. It's a part of the same like franchise or universe. I don't necessarily think it's part of the same series, quote unquote, in the sense that it's just such a different game mechanically, right?
Yeah.
Than that. But then you have something like 5, which is pretty much, you know, it's the same. It's essentially like the Snake Eater like formula, like on steroids with that open world stuff. And it's actually a game that's produced probably some of the best writing on video games that I've ever read. So that's like a kudos to Metal Gear 5. But 4, it's just, yeah, I wish I liked it more. And I wish, because my experience with it like really soured me on just Kojima. You know, like it was just so much. Yeah, no, I mean, I still think he's like, you know, he's one of the great, and he's one of the great like video game like directors, and you know, it's not just like the Metal Gear series. I think people tend to forget, you know, his other work as well with stuff like Snatcher, right? Mm-hmm. Like Police Knots and like all these other stuff that's just like amazing. Which I hope those games get more of like a wider release at some point. And also like Son of the Enders and what is it, Boktai, the GBA game as well. That's like pretty.
The Sun Is in Your Hands.
Yeah, that's incredible idea. Horrible execution because of the hardware.
Yeah, they did that. There's a DS, you know, Lunar Nights was like the spiritual kind of like follow through on that as well too. But it just didn't have that solar sensor to be able to keep playing it on the DS. Kojima's got some interesting ideas, and he always does something kind of funky and crazy. And yeah, like, you know, does it always stick? You know, not necessarily, but there's at least some chunks out of there that you can savor. And I'm always just curious to see how he'll surprise or, you know, shake things up. So, four though, I'm with you on that. Like, it definitely tested my fandom of the series. Like, you know, I don't think it jeopardized it at all for me, because I still like kind of wrote it out and, you know, into the sunset with the end of it all. But it had opportunities to like where it struggled to grow where it needed to, and where it was kind of held back by, you know, other shortcomings. But graphically amazing, you know, had really cool like mechanics and ideas. It's just, you know, nothing you can really fully flex like your muscles on. But cool, I do like that answer.
No, and just like one last thing, I can't overstate how hype I was for this, because I love Snake Eater. It's one of my favorite games. And then on top of that, earlier in that same year, 2008, you know, Smash Brothers Brawl came out, and Snake was a playable character. Mm-hmm. So just for months, you know, if you were playing that game, you were playing as like Snake. So you were just like, oh my God, just like prepping yourself for it. And then it happened, and it's like, oh, at least for me, I know a lot of people still enjoy it, and it has a lot of merits. Like, I'm not saying it, I'm not saying this is like, it's a bad game. It's just personally, you know, it just didn't click with me, and I have specific issues with that game.
I fight emotionally, like in my head, like, do I not enjoy it as much because of its flaws and I just could not oversee them? Or is it because I've not been able to replay it like I have so many of the other games because it being locked? Like, I wonder sometimes if it is magically re-released and made available again, would I play it and have like a newfound like appreciation for some of those things? Or will it just, you know, even more so feel dated with its design of like pacing and exposition dumping and things like that, you know? So it's almost like I don't want it to be made available again to like reopen that wound of disappointment. But at the same time, if I'm left sitting here feeling half disappointed by the memories of it, you know, what is there to really lose? So it's, you know, who knows what's, you know, how really going to shake out if there ever is a re-release.
I think I might enjoy it more, actually, when I think about it. And the reason why is just because the AAA games just have changed so much and just almost exclusively gone to this route of like open world game design, that just getting something that we just so much, you know, so much smaller and like restrictive in like the game worlds that you're allowed to like interact with, I think that would be a breath of fresh air. And this is also one of the games where when I played it, I'm like, oh, I don't need graphics to be any better than the, you know, like I was just like, oh, this is like amazing. Like if graphics just like stop at this point, I would be completely fine. And they didn't, and we're suffering for it in the industry because every freaking studio is like shutting down because production costs are too high for their games. And, you know, when they release a game, if it doesn't sell like 30 million copies, it's like a bust. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is getting close to, you know, that production crunch and team size and all that stuff. But obviously, you know, the PS3 was a little bit more manageable for a team than some of these modern games are. But yeah, it's yeah, writing was kind of on the wall then that there was things coming, stresses were coming in the foundation. But cool. Thank you so much for jumping on another episode, Luis. We will we'll have you on again in the future for sure. And yeah. You had offline or before recording, you had shared some of the recent articles you've had online. I'll make sure I get those from you and I'll put those in the show notes so folks can kind of follow the links and see some of the recent things you've been putting out. Yeah, otherwise, do you have anything you want to share then before we wrap up?
Yeah, just have a few things. So you can find my work on popmatters.com. Just recently published a review of Neva, the new Nomada Studio game. They're the creator of Grease, which is the storytelling platform, the narrative platformer. Have that. I have a few other things coming in the pipeline. The big thing though that I like to pitch is, so I'm a member of the New York Video Games Critics Circle. Our award is coming up in January, which is the New York Video Game Awards. It's kind of a big deal, if I don't mind saying it. So we're gonna have, you know, we're gonna have a pretty good show. And the tickets are available if anybody wants to go. All the proceeds go to our nonprofit, which is essentially help for us. It's like we help at risk like youths in New York City area with educational opportunities in the classroom and also internships. So it goes to a good cause. We try to do a lot of good work when it comes to that. So it's not only about like, you know, having fun and playing games, but it's also like making a difference with it. And I, on that note too, with the New York Video Games Critics Circle, I have a podcast coming out with them, which I'll be speaking with Remy Zhu, who is the creative director of A Thousand Times Resist, which if anybody's heard of it, it's in my opinion the best game of the year. So be on the lookout for that as well.
Right. Yeah. I will get those links from you then, and we'll put those in the show notes below. But thanks again for jumping on, and I'm sure we'll talk very soon about more video games.